This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. Today's guest is Ronnie Driver of Virgin Money to discuss what we have learned from the last 10 years of stress testing.
Hello and welcome everybody to the next edition of Treasury Matters, the podcast from ALMA, that's the UK Asset and Liability Management Association. As ever, my name is Justin Fox, I'm chair of ALMA, but I'm also the treasurer of Virgin Money. And I'm really pleased to welcome my next guest onto the podcast, and I'd like to introduce Ronnie Driver, who I think I get the correct title, Ronnie, is Head of Stress Testing at Virgin Money. Is that right?
That's right.
And Ronnie, just for people listening in, can you provide a short summary on your sort of career background and why you sort of ended up in the position that you are right now?
Of course. And first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's really great to be here to talk to you today on a topic that, as you know, is very, very close to my heart. So I started my career as an economist. Actually, I studied economics at undergraduate and postgraduate, and then went to work for the Bank of England, analysing the UK economy to support the Monetary Policy Committee in their assessment of interest rates and latterly quantitative easing. And I did that for a number of years. But then I wanted to do something different when the crisis happened, and I moved to the markets area of the bank, where I spent a long time working on the design and operation of the Bank of England's balance sheet, which was incredibly fascinating, but very unique at the same time. But it gave me an appetite for balance sheet management, and I wanted to do it for real in a commercial bank. And I was fortunate enough to be able to arrange a secondment to RBS Group Treasury, now NatWest, of course, where I spent 2.5 fond years doing a range of project work, including work on recovery planning, capital management, liquidity risk, and a bit of resolution planning on the side as well. I was then back at the Bank of England to run their bank's resilience division in the financial stability part of the bank. That division was responsible for analysing the financial resilience of the major UK banks. And so we did a lot of work very close to stress testing, but I wanted to run the stress test as well. So I then had this opportunity that arose, and I came out to do it here at VM, where I've been for the last handful of years. And I look after the ACS, the annual cyclical scenario, which is the Bank of England's concurrent stress test, as well as the ICAP Pillar 2B and some of the climate stress testing work that we run as well.
Let me start with my first question. Because one of the things that you've done in your role is look at ACS from both a Bank of England perspective, but also from a firm perspective. And when you and I were chatting about this a moment ago, it's hard to believe that stress testing from a Bank of England framework is 10 years old. Why did the regulators want a stress testing framework in place? What was the sort of policy objective, I guess, from their perspective?
Well, as with many things in the banking regulation arena, you can trace the origin of this pretty much to the great financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. And that crisis really exposed a whole host of vulnerabilities among banks and gaps in the regulatory framework that applied at the time. Most obviously, it demonstrated that the banks had insufficient loss absorbing capacity, and that's both the quantity and the quality of capital. Some banks were levered up to 40 to 50 times. That's a huge amount of risk for an institution to be taking. And finding and the revelation of that vulnerability and the consequences of it paved the way for some very extensive regulatory reform, some of which is still going on even now, 15 years later. The main one here that's relevant to this conversation is Basel III, which significantly increased capital requirements for banks, both from a minimum capital position, but also introducing a range of additional capital buffers, some of which apply to everyone, some of which apply for systemic banks, some of which apply to the ring-fenced banking entities. They will scale up with, depending on the systemic importance of the entity. And so the banks were on this enormous journey, multi-year journey, to rebuild their positions. And the authorities were obviously keen to make sure that they were making good enough progress on that, while at the same time also restoring some confidence to the banking system, demonstrating that it's resilient and could withstand a severe stress were it to happen again. And that's really where stress testing came in. The purpose of the stress testing framework really, I think, was to provide a forward-looking quantitative assessment of capital adequacy and an independent view based on detailed analysis by the regulatory authority that the system was resilient. Now, of course, banks have been running individual stress tests in ICAAPs long before that. The key innovation for ACS, in my opinion, really was the concurrency of the test. The banks are all subject to the same scenario. The rules of the test, which require them to maintain a certain amount of lending to give comfort to the regulators they'd be able to continue to support the economy in a stress, and the provision of consistent and extensive structured and unstructured data submissions, which really enabled a very detailed and granular review and challenge of the assumptions and the results that banks were submitting by the regulator. And in that way, the ACS was really able to shed insights on the resilience of the system as a whole,
yeah,
as well as just the solvency of the individual banks. That macro view, the ability to look at the system as a whole, as a collective, was a really key innovation, and also why the ACS was housed under the auspices of the Financial Policy Committee, responsible for macroprudential policy, rather than with the microprudential regulator, although, of course, they work very closely together.
Just to build on that a little bit, so if I think about it from a regulator's point of view, because everybody's having to do the same thing, the same scenario, the same submissions, when you look at, let's say, portfolio details, you can do a really decent cross comparison in terms of strengths and weaknesses between different institutions who might have slightly different approaches. Is that a fair comment?
Absolutely. You can look at strengths and weaknesses in terms of how banks prepare their results, but it can also enforce some consistency in submissions.
Yeah.
So a really good example of that is if you take assumptions about loan markets, when banks think about what they would do in a stress from a quantity and pricing perspective, they're all doing it, making their decisions and their assumptions on an individual basis. But in reality, the market has to clear.
Yeah.
And there can only be one clearing price in the market. And so that individual submissions and comparing them, the Bank of England is able to make some judgments around what would actually happen were all the banks to do the things they think they were going to do in the stress, and hence impose a degree of consistency. Similarly, because they have insight into, let's say, the asset quality of the different banks' portfolios, they can do some benchmarking of credit risk results, cognizant of where different banks' model suites and model limitation may sit, and make sure that, again, there's some consistency in the judgments that are applied, particularly to capture some of the tail ends of the stress, which are difficult to model. And a good example of this may be in the last ACS that they ran, which was a high inflation scenario. You know, we hadn't had an inflation scenario like that since the ACS had started, with inflation got to about 17% in the ACS 22. And that's a very difficult thing for people to model the impact of. So a lot of judgment would have been important, and the bank would have wanted to make sure that there was some consistency across the piece. So these are the kind of the ways they would analyze the results. And I say the benefit of the concurrent scenario is that they get to see how everyone across the peer group thinks about these difficult challenges and can enforce consistency.
Correct if I'm wrong here. Normally, or at least the process has been, is that there's an annual cyclical stress test. But additionally, for very large firms, there's a biennial scenario that can sometimes be run. So every 2 years, they're being asked to do a much longer time series, maybe 10 years plus. Is that right?
It's mostly right. The ACS is an annual test, which they've been running for the past 10 years. There were a couple that were cancelled in the more recent time periods.
Because of COVID and things.
Because of COVID and things like that. They do have this complementary biennial scenario, which the same major UK banks are invited to participate in. The bank has recently, you know, it's done a range of these exploratory scenarios on different topics.
Climate was one, right?
Yeah, participants will be defined by the extent to which they're relevant. So it started off with one on business model risk, if I can call it that, where they were testing the impact of very low rates for a prolonged period and coupled with increased competition and digitization in deposit markets. Then they had a liquidity-based test, which was assessing the impact of a collective withdrawal of deposits from the major UK banks simultaneously, which is an interesting scenario in the context of some of the developments around private stablecoin and digital money. They then had the climate biennial scenario in 2021, which obviously paved the way for a an extensive agenda on climate and nature-related resilience. And they're now currently in the process of running a non-bank test, or it's called a system-wide exploratory scenario, where they've invited some of the major banks that are active in core financial markets and some of the big non-bank institutions that also play in those markets to do a test to understand the resilience of those markets to stress. And that's drawing on the experience of the trust budget in September 2023 and the significant moves in financial markets that we saw around that time and the consequential impact on liability-driven investment strategies and pension funds. And that's triggered a lot of interest in how the bank and non-bank interaction plays out and what it means for systemically important markets in the UK. So they do these exploratory things every other year in principle, with the participants defined by the business models and the relevance.
And to be clear, when we think about stress testing in the context of the Bank of England, it's very much focused on capital adequacy. It's not necessarily a liquidity-driven stress that you would say run in an ILAP, but it does look at, has to look at the impact on sort of liabilities as part of that overall assessment. So it is a complete holistic type approach, but it's really focused on capital. That's the right way to describe it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a test of the entire balance sheet. So you have to model the whole piece, assets and liabilities, and indeed submit detailed templates that cover not just capital adequacy, but also liquidity and funding resilience. The nature of the scenario just makes it so that capital is ultimately the primary aspect that's being tested, because it's a very severe macro scenario that typically hits credit assets significantly, but there's certainly a liquidity angle to it. I say the liquidity system-wide exploratory scenario they ran in 2019 had a different objective, which was not so much to target capital, but to target and understand banks' liquidity recovery actions individually and collectively, to try and understand that and understand also banks' relationships with central bank facilities and the extent to which they would be willing to draw how much and under what circumstances from the bank's liquidity insurance framework. So it comes back to the question of what is the primary objective of the test, whether it has a more capital focus or a different one.
And one of the perennial challenges, I mean, you and I have sat in those meetings with the Bank of England, is clearly it's an incredibly rigorous process and it takes a lot of time to both design but also for firms to manage and deliver the stress tests. One of the areas the bank is always interested in is how firms use the learnings from these exercises. From your point of view, what's a good example of how firms should be thinking about incorporating this process into their internal view? Because clearly you've looked at it from the policy side. You're having those discussions internally. What's your perspective on that?
So I certainly think it's fair to say that there's a very extensive amount of work that goes into producing these results, both in terms of time, effort, and data outputs. So it's not cheap. And so I actually think because of that, it's even more critical that banks embrace and use the results for their own internal purposes, not just to satisfy regulatory requirement or expectation and to make sure that they pass the test. And I think there's lots of ways that you can do that because it's such a rich data set. And once you build up a library of these scenarios over time, you've got quite a powerful tool to think about your business. So some examples I would pick out, most basically is to inform capital targets and allocations across group and legal entities. Given your portfolio, how much capital do you think you need to operate comfortably and command market confidence and regulatory confidence? And you could do that just by sizing your capital buffers to make sure that you can clear your minimum requirements or internal appetites by a certain threshold. Then you can go more granular and you can consider how you use stress testing in, let's say, setting risk appetites. So, your board would legitimately say, well, if I want to set my appetite for these following portfolios in the following ways, would I run any additional risk of not passing a stress test? And you can test that kind of question and you can figure out if you have more or less headroom for key portfolios based on your appetites. And then the third use I think I'd point to is slightly more complex one that really requires a data heavy approach, but it's to think about portfolio optimization. Think of the bank as an asset allocation problem. You want to understand the mean and the variance of the returns by asset class and the correlations across them. And then you can build an optimized portfolio off the back of that. To do that, you obviously need a range of scenarios. You need to understand the return profiles in multiple states of the world, not just the base. But if you can build that kind of matrix over time that tells you how your portfolio would perform under different scenarios, you can build a very capital efficient position for the bank. There's lots of ways you can use it.
Yeah, or determine what you do with some of the portfolios that you have on the balance sheet and how they can be better optimized. As you say, you can get into quite a lot of granular detail, right?
Yeah, and another example of that will be thinking about securitization or risk transfer. We can identify the pockets of your portfolio that are particularly capital consumptive in stress and think, can you do some securitization transaction that lays off the risk to a third party in a way that is optimal for both counterparties in the trade? So you can get into all that kind of detail as well. And then that has further use cases for supporting recovery planning.
Exactly.
You can go down the rest of the spectrum and kind of figure out where you can get the most bang for your buck.
If I then take a slightly different pivot, you said earlier that the genesis for this is really off the events in the global financial crisis. So what happened over 2007 to 2009, and those were multi-year capital stress test events. Given the rapid failures we saw in 2023, is there a way of also rethinking the role of stress testing given those events, or is this seen as being complementary in terms of how firms, but also how regulators think about the usefulness of stress testing?
So I think the events of 2023 are very instructive here, because I think they reinforce that stress testing is a critical discipline, but also that looking just at capital adequacy is not really going to be enough. And if I take a step back, if I think about the journey that the banks have been on from a capital rebuild perspective, UK bank capital levels are now very healthy, something around 14.5% for the major tier one banks, higher than that even for the smaller tier banks. And subsequent stress test exercises have shown repeated passes. So it's clear that, you know, from a capital perspective, the resilience of the system is very strong. And so I think there's a legitimate question to ask whether there should be some rebalancing away from exercises that focus annually on capital, and whether we start exploring some of the other challenges and other risks that we've seen. And we've talked about some of these already in the biennial scenarios on liquidity, system-wide scenarios. Operational risk is another area, which I know that the Bank of England's been thinking hard about as a vulnerability that needs to make sure that it has sufficient coverage. I also think one of the lessons from 2023, if you look at America and Silicon Valley Bank and the fallout from it, is thinking about the sample of banks that you look at.
Yes.
And I'm not necessarily advocating for all the smaller banks to be subject to an ACS, but I think there's been a long noted challenge that a lot of the smaller banks, while not individually systemic, could be systemic as a cohort. And that's what we saw in the US regional banks crisis in 2023. You know, it's lots of very interesting research that tries to explain and set out the multiple failings that led to the problems that ultimately culminated in the failures over there. For me, having some stress testing program could have identified some of those vulnerabilities for those smaller firms earlier. And then I think also one other point I'd say is that sometimes it's not even just capital and liquidity. You know, we've also learnt, if you look at Credit Suisse as an example, that it can be just as much business model risk, reputational risk, these kind of events that ultimately lead to a slower burn, but nonetheless failure of a bank. And those things are very hard to test in a quantitative framework, but doesn't make them any less important to consider and think about. And so I think there's lots of other risks one can think of and bring scenario analysis to that aren't capital specifically.
That may then lead to different approaches being taken by the regulators. So what we've seen is, rather than in some years very intensive end-to-end process, towards a more desktop driven exercise, which to your point may be more appropriate for smaller firms, but then you look at the systemic risks that they pose collectively. Is that a fair description?
So I think the desk-based stress testing piece is a very important and interesting concept. If I take a step back, ACS exercises currently take 9 months end-to-end to run, from scenario launch to scenario results publication. It's a nine-month process, and it's a single scenario. Now, that is a long time, and quite often the world has moved on a fair bit by the time the results are published. So I think that desk-based stress testing is important if it can be used as a way to facilitate faster stress test execution and as a result of that, enable the running of more scenarios across a different range of severities to cover the whole spectrum from moderate downside all the way to the ACS severity and recovery severity as well. That will necessarily come with the trade-off, and the trade-off will be that there'll be a reduced degree of rigor, review, and challenge, and it'll be a more mechanical process. But if we can accept that that's a consequence and a choice that we're happy with, I think that it is highly valuable because it gives people the opportunity to do much more rapid, targeted tests, responding to the live political and geopolitical environment or economic environment, and really give more insights to decision makers in banks to try and get ahead of a lot of the questions that boards and risk leaders will have in changing economic circumstances.
It's showing that sort of flexibility, but that only must work where you've got a reasonably mature process. And as you said a few moments ago, if you look in the UK context, for the very large banks, they have very healthy capital bases and therefore are showing consistent passes. So that sort of more flexible approach works possibly best in a mature process?
I think so. You know, I can understand that during the capital journey that I described at the beginning, when resilience was lower as measured in terms of capital adequacy, there may have been a strong appetite to maintain the depth and degree of rigor that we've seen through previous stress tests. The question is now whether there's any space to tilt the balance. And it's interesting, you know, the Bank of England, as I said earlier, have cancelled a couple of the ACS exercises in recent years. Yeah. They're currently doing an exploratory scenario that's of a bigger scope than previously. So they're clearly interested in exploring more. And they're currently in the process of doing this 10-year thematic review of stress testing, which we await eagerly to see the outcomes of at the end of this year to understand how they may change the framework in the future. So there's clearly a lot of thought going into this at the moment.
We haven't touched on this, but in terms of stakeholder reaction and stakeholder thoughts on when they see stress test results, if you're an investor, if you're a counterparty, how should you be looking at the sort of information that's being shared? How much value should this be giving you in terms of how you think about it?
So I think this is probably a game of two halves. I think at the beginning of stress testing, there was a lot of attention paid to the results by people in the market, investors and the like, because the memories of the crisis were so fresh and the capital rebuild journey was so early in its maturity. I think in more recent years, like you said earlier, the fact that banks now past the stress test year on year, there's been less attention paid to the results. I'm not entirely sure that's necessarily fair. If I was sitting in an equity analyst seat, for example, or a debt investor house, I'd be looking to understand, again, over time and over a series of tests, what the stress loss rates tell me about different banks' business model. And I'd be using that to have a look at the relative value positions of different trades I could strike on there. AT1 instruments, senior non-preferred debt instruments. I think there's value in that. There is an awful lot of information that comes out in the results, so it is quite difficult to analyze all and internalize it, but there's definitely some value in them.
When you do that sort of benchmarking work, it is certainly of value to boards to understand the relative positioning of your institution. So you can think about, let's say, well, my view of risk appetite is X. Is that really being validated by the results we're seeing here when we look at the cross comparison?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd be very surprised if it wasn't the case at every bank that the moment the results are published, the first thing that the stress testing teams do is try to figure out what their most similar peers have done and what insights they can glean from it. I think there's a few areas where the transparency of the disclosures that the bank put out could probably be improved to help that a bit more. But absolutely.
And so let's tease this out a little bit. You look at your end-to-end capital framework, thinking about, I suppose, optimal balance sheet management, to your earlier point, asset allocation, but also getting into that sort of cyclical process whereby I know I've got to do a stress test for my recovery plan. I've got to come up with stress test scenarios for my ICAP. How can you leverage those capabilities? put it another way, you know, what are the top critical issues for firms to think about when they think about their end-to-end sort of framework, I suppose, is probably a better way of putting it.
So in terms of the first part of your question, yeah. I see ICAP and ACS in a very similar bucket in terms of stress severity. They're both intended to be in that tail risk of the distribution. But stress testing is just one part of a broader family of work called scenario analysis. And that actually applies across the entire spectrum of exercises that banks currently participate in. So corporate planning, downside yeah. sensitivities, moderate stress to test profitability, distribution capacity. Then you get to ICAP and ACS level of tests. Then you get to recovery planning type tests, which bring you right to the point of non-viability. And then ultimately yeah. you get resolution type tests where you kind of have to demonstrate you can either do a restructuring or recover in a resolvability scenario. So for me, that is just a spectrum. And I think that some of these exercises or demands have developed to different cadences and have come into play at different points in time. But there's definitely a bit of standing back and joining up that one can do in order to make sure these are actually a spectrum and that you reuse and reutilize the insights from your ICAP into your recovery plan, where you find a way to make sure there's consistency there and how you yeah. use your scenarios across that spectrum. I think that's a really important thing to do. And that's an efficiency unlocker for banks, I think.
But I would have thought that's also really important for boards who aren't as embedded in the day-to-day process, because they're constantly trying to stitch this sort of patchwork quilt together of disparate things coming to them. Is that a fair reflection too?
Absolutely. And they may, of course, come to them at different points in the year and,
yes.
and in a non-chronological way, if that makes sense. So they may get their resolution assessment before they get their corporate plan or their ACS. Yeah. And so it's being able to think about the stress tests on a spectrum and reusing and maintaining consistency is really important. I think you asked in terms of what are the top things to think about in terms of an end-to-end process.
Yes.
I think a couple of things here. So the first one is having a really good planning and stakeholder engagement process. And that sometimes feels like a bit of a hard slog or a bit of a thankless task, but having this done well can very easily be the difference between a successful execution and an unsuccessful one, especially if you're working in an organization that operates stress tests on a hub and spoke model as opposed to a centralized model. And that's because the stress testing timetables are generally very challenging and involve a number of touch points and handshakes across different functions as you bring results together. And so it's like a domino chain, and you need to make sure that the dominoes don't all fall at the wrong time. So that's really key. I think the second one is to have a really good grip on your data and model landscape. What are the data quality issues or the main data quality issues that you face, and how do you manage them to make sure that you have faith and credibility in your outputs? What model limitations do you have, and how do you try to correct for them in a stress to ensure your outputs are credible? These are difficult challenges, and they're one of the impediments to the desk-based process, the centralized process that I mentioned earlier. But that's the second one I think is key. And then the third one, I think, is managing the outputs well. And those of us who have done lots of these stress tests know that they produce an enormous amount of data that can be quite overwhelming for many audiences, including for those of us who have to get a handle on the overall results and the narrative and put it together in a format that's easily digestible and appropriate for a board level audience. And so there's a real art in being able to distill all that as part of going through governance and having a real focus on the key judgments that have a material impact on the results, and having a good handle on the sensitivity of the results to different assumptions and which ones really matter and which ones matter a little bit less. Because quite often it's that understanding, and the sensitivity understanding in particular, that gives you the real insights for risk management and into where to focus more time and attention, either in future tests or just as part of your BAU risk management process. Those are, I think, the key building blocks for me, at least, of running a really successful end-to-end stress testing process.
And I suppose, go back to your earlier point, is how do you embed stress testing right within your firm? I have seen firms take the results and look at particular business areas and say, actually, is that generating the right level of return? Is that consistent with where we want to go? Maybe we're on a restructuring journey. Does that support that sort of activity? It's that sort of organic learning. And I've seen firms turn around and say, actually, no, we're not going to do this particular type of business because When we model it through a stress testing point of view, it produces results that we aren't comfortable with from a risk appetite point of view. And that I suppose what I'm trying to get to is how that sort of, again, it's back to that point about how are firms really thinking about this. The other point I'd like to come on to, and I'll let you answer that first question, but while it's in my brain, you made a really good point about how you organize and work with the whole bank and working with commercial teams, because clearly getting commercial input, I mean, clearly it's really important to have risk colleagues alongside you and internal audit, but working with the commercial teams, because ultimately it will deliver insights into their business that they can help. And the role of, let's say, expert panels in both demonstrating that you've got good guidance and control around the process, but also you're really getting that richness of that insight. So those are sort of two things, sorry, to come at you.
I'll try to answer them in turn. I've written a little note down to try and remind myself of the second one. So on the first bit, you're absolutely right. You definitely want to understand if the returns you're getting during base are actually completely insufficient to cover you for the risk and stress. Because otherwise you end up in a position where you think you've got a really healthy business model, but actually it's very volatile, subject to economic conditions, and you can't achieve your objectives. And so that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier on around thinking about the returns and the variances on your assets and the correlation among them.
Yeah.
As you can start to build that kind of efficient portfolio. But I think for a board, you know, you want to be using stress testing as a tool to test the objectives that you want to achieve. So let's say, for example, that you have a solvency appetite at a board level that says I want to maintain a particular capital ratio because that's a level that I feel good about. At the same time, you also have a profitability target and a payout ratio policy that you want to meet because of your investor base or because of aspirations to drive up your share price. The two may be incompatible. You know, it's very easy to eliminate your solvency risk by just holding lots and lots of capital, but of course you will not be able to deliver on your return targets. The converse is obviously also true, where you can easily get some very high level returns on equity if you have a thin capital base, which is basically the constellation we saw in the run-up to the crisis.
Yes.
And so stress testing lets you try and triangulate between those two examples that I just set out and figure out where can you put your business in the sweet spot where you can meet both objectives to your satisfaction, and what do you need to give up in order to move the needle one way or the other. And I say, once you've built up a sufficient history of stress tests, because you can't place reliance on just any one particular scenario, once you've built up a history of stress tests, you can start making those judgments and assessments. In terms of your second question on the commercial teams, I think the commercial teams' involvement, and actually generally this goes for all SMEs actually, across commercial, treasury, risk, finance, is really important because it drives up the quality of the conversations around stress testing significantly, both from an input perspective, because these people, taking commercial as an example, you know, they work in these markets for mortgages, credit cards, deposits. They work in them day in, day out. And so they have a very good handle on how the market may react on the different scenarios, and also corporate longevity and understanding based on history of each bank's specific product set, brand, and the like. So they can bring incredible amounts of value to the decision process and the discussion process around assumptions. The quid pro quo from that's got to be that having made that investment, they get something from the outputs as well.
Yes, exactly.
And that's where, you know, after all the stress test is done, you want to go back out to them and say, well, here's all the assumptions you put in, and in this scenario, here's what it meant in terms of the profitability of your business or the risk to your business. And here's some things you might want to think about as a result of that in terms of which products to lean into more or less, or any other changes you want to make in pricing or otherwise. And that loop becomes a virtuous loop and is really important to embed. And I say that's not just for commercial teams, it's also for all other teams involved in the stress test process.
And I suppose two points to that, if you could offer some thought, is one, that's where the value of having that rich data set output from the regulator or the Bank of England, when you can look at your portfolios versus others. I mean, clearly you're not going to get into micro detail, but that's of value. And one way to express the benefit of the learnings is, I guess, through your planning process. So we learned X about our businesses through the stress test. Okay, team, how are you then going to reflect that in your business strategy and your planning assumptions going forward? Any particular thoughts on those two aspects?
Just that exactly that process needs to happen and needs to be embedded within the minds of the people running these exercises. Sometimes there's still a bit of an element of the stress test is run over here and the corporate plan is run over there, but there needs to be that virtuous loop, I say, that goes round and draws the insights from stress tests and uses them to inform strategy. To my earlier example, you know, you don't want to build a plan where you write a bunch of business that performs great in base conditions, but it only takes a small economic shock to wipe out your business. That is not a plan that a board should be happy to sign up to. And so once people go to their boards with their plans, they should bring some insights based on stress test that says, here's where you should be comfortable with this particular plan we have and this particular constellation of growth or mix or whatever.
And that's where sometimes a sprint exercise, so back to your point around the desktops, if you're doing a corporate plan, applying a sprint or a desktop exercise around testing its vulnerabilities, again, is a good tool to be able to develop in terms of what insight it brings to firms when looking through that process.
Yeah, exactly. And at a very basic level, that can be as simple as saying, here's the losses that we experienced on different asset classes in historic stress tests. And if we apply them to this balance sheet, we have great comfort that we will not have a capital problem relative to the risk appetite that the board has set. That's a simple exercise. You can then layer on additional complexity, of course, but there's definitely ways to bring that insight in.
You talked earlier about some of the challenges in stress test modeling around different risks posed to firms. So it's more straightforward to look at, say, credit risk, liquidity risk, market risk through a stress test. When you look at multivariate risks, so I'm thinking about cyber, those operational resilience points, and what are the particular challenges in looking at those multi-layered risks? Is that really where the future lies, is looking at those multivariate, perhaps through biennial type, longer term scenarios where stress testing really goes? And that my second question is really, what is stress testing 2.0? We've had 10 years in the UK. It's been an incredibly valuable tool. What are your thoughts in terms of, if you look at the next 10 years of stress testing, where would it be pointing towards?
Well, I think the two things are actually very closely connected, so I might answer them. I might answer them jointly. And I think that if I step back, the capital position, as I said, is strong, and there's probably a bit less value in repeatedly running similar scenarios year to year, especially if your balance sheet is relatively stable, and especially if you are a geographic monoline in the UK or a product monoline in the UK, right? You're solely mortgage provider or solely cards provider. Yeah. There's only so many ways that you can design a scenario of that severity that hit the UK economy. You know, you crush GDP, you put unemployment at 8, 9, 10%, and you crush house prices, that generates your impairments in these scenarios. So there's only so many ways you can do that. If you're a global bank or if you have a big traded risk function, there's obviously a lot more different vulnerabilities you can test. So there may be some element there that the bank might think about as part of the thematic review, and particularly given that all the banks have to run ICAAPs anyway, and so maybe there's a synergy for those, or a proportionality approach for those banks that are geographically concentrated or product concentrated, where they can do a bit less in the capital space and create a bit more space to do some of the exploratory stuff, which I think is where your first question comes in. I think there's going to have to be a lot more attention over the next 10 years on the non-financial risk elements of stress testing, which is very difficult because we haven't got time series history, we haven't got quantitative data. It's not something you can model with equations, but it doesn't make it any less important. And I think that covers a whole range of areas, you know, cyber stress testing, where the Financial Policy Committee has a cyber stress testing program, and there's also a bunch of other industry programs that do penetration testing and recovery testing for cyber, which is really important that work continues. But there's also other tests around, let's say, critical third-party failure. You know, what do you do if you have a failure of the electricity network?
Bloomberg, let's say, or Bloomberg.
Or any critical third party that is heavily embedded in the financial infrastructure, especially in an increasingly digital age. You know, what's the recovery position around incidents like that? And very importantly, it's important to do that individually as firms, of course, but this is where the regulator might be interested from a macroprudential perspective. What if everyone is using the same provider and that provider has a critical failure? Then there's a real problem. And then you get to contingency planning, you get to fallbacks. I think that's an area that's going to be very important to focus on. But as I say, very challenging. And I'm pretty sure that if it does go that way, I'll have to retrain at some point during the rest of my career, because I'm not don't know very much about that stuff personally. So I look forward to that.
Clearly, what we've been talking about is stress testing for banks, let's say large building societies. We've seen it extended to insurance companies, and you said the biennial scenario will look at a range of other firms. If you look at it across the whole picture, we've seen the growth of private credit and other lending activities that were historically done by banks, but they've moved to other parts of the financial system. Is there a need and a benefit for extending how stress testing is used in firms that aren't effectively deposit-taking institutions?
So I'm sure the answer to that will be yes. I think the challenge will be, well, some of these institutions aren't regulated in the same way that banks are, or if they are, then the regulatory bodies that govern them maybe don't have that same infrastructure or capability set up at the moment to do those tests. I do think that as more activity migrates out of the banking system, particularly higher risk activity, which the regulations have by design made less economic now than in previous years, and hence has migrated outside the so-called shadow banking system. How does one keep an eye on that? Even from a data collection in BAU perspective, it's very difficult to get high quality data on some of these activities from some of these counterparties. The real risk is that somehow, even though the risk has been laid off outside the banking system, it somehow finds its way back in, either through banks providing the finance and providing the credit lines to these non-bank entities, and somehow providing leverage on assets that sit outside the banking system but are obviously still risky. And so that is a potential challenge. I mean, you mentioned private credit. I think private credit is still pretty small in the grand scheme of things in terms of banks' balance sheet, but I know that's a question that's live, and the Bank of England has done some reviews on the private credit market to understand these linkages between the core banks and these non-bank providers. And I think that's really key, because ultimately at the end of the day, that the whole purpose of the capital reform program and the stress testing program to determine resilience is all around protecting depositors ultimately, which is what, you know, the thing that banks uniquely provide is the safe store of money for the general public, and hence needing to make sure that there's no risk that those deposits are compromised due to risky asset taking on the other side of the balance sheet. So I think that's the challenge, and the system-wide scenario that I mentioned earlier, which is starting to bring in some of the non-bank counterparties, is an important first step in that regard. But I do think it's a challenge, given these are internationally dispersed organizations and markets, and the data capture is patchy at best.
If I then extend it, because you talk about multi-jurisdictional firms, another challenge will be in terms of the consistency of approach applied by different regulators. So I know that, for example, the EBA stress testing framework is very different to that within the UK. And their argument is, well, look, we've got larger numbers of banks that we need to regulate. So we have to make some simplifications in our approach to be able to accommodate that. So being able to judge that sort of consistency amongst different jurisdictions is also quite a tricky challenge.
It's a very tricky challenge for those banks who have to manage multiple regulators. And remember, of course, that underpinning that in the background, there'll be different political undertones that have set the agenda and the requirements, the demands and the expectations of the regulators in terms of bank resilience and safety. I think it's also a problem when, you know, if you're headquartered in one regulatory regime, but you have a lot of activity in others.
That is a challenge, because how to get that multi-layered agreement between different regulatory bodies. CCAR is very different to an ACS. EBA is very different. We've had the IMF run some stress tests as well. And there's no magic silver bullet that would resolve those issues. It's part of the rich complexity of how to manage a stress testing process that firms and regulators need to navigate, I suppose.
So absolutely, it's very challenging when you're multi-jurisdictional, because, as you say, different regulators will have different expectations and different stress testing frameworks and rules. And as you say, the Europeans have got a different approach because of the number of banks they have. It's also the case that regulatory reform is being implemented at different times in different jurisdictions. You know, we haven't talked about Basel 3.1, but that's a very good example of just this. The EBA stress test this year is being run on a Basel 3.1 basis, which is, you know, going to be a very interesting exercise, but obviously that's not the way that other countries are currently doing it.
You also have changes in accounting policy, because that's been an important part within the UK. So the adjustment to IFRS 9, right, that's also been an important consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. And the differences in accounting standards between the UK and the US, for example, you know, I remember that causing complication in terms of analyst interpretation of results when you're trying to understand and compare consistently for banks that have multi-jurisdictional footprints. It gets difficult. I'm not sure there's a great way around that. Ultimately, the stress testing frameworks are a product of the regulatory authorities' appetites, and then the kind of political context going on in all those countries at those periods of time. It would be nice to have a unified global stress testing framework that all the banks could follow, irrespective of where they're located, but I think we're quite a long way from that.
Well, the challenge is, as you said, take something like Basel 3.1. That's an attempt to create a consistent standard, but clearly we've seen a lot of challenge over the last few years from the US versus Europe versus the UK. So even just setting common rules that everybody has to apply, the next level up is stress testing. So that creates the challenge.
And you see it even with how different authorities use stress tests. So I mentioned at the beginning that the ACS in the UK is owned by the Macroprudential Authority, the Financial Policy Committee, and they use it to inform their countercyclical capital buffer assessment, which they impose on the UK banks and vary it countercyclically. But the UK is one of a very small number of jurisdictions at the last count that sets a non-zero buffer. Other macroprudential authorities don't impose that requirement on their banks. You can get into a debate about what the right thing to do is there. Even in terms of using the stress test results, it doesn't seem that there's conformity among global regulators on what the best way to use them are.
Ronnie, is there a question I haven't yet asked that I should have asked when thinking about stress testing?
I don't think so. I think they're all covered.
Yeah, I think we've covered everything. So to summarize, it's a pretty mature process for what it was designed to do initially. And actually, if you've got a mature process like stress testing, you've got a number of firms who've been doing it for a number of years. Presumably, for a new firm being sort of admitted to that club, let's call it a club, there's quite a challenge organizationally, because it is expensive. It is very time consuming around what you need to do to meet the requirements. And to be fair to the Bank of England, they set very exacting standards here. Any views on how to help firms who may be faced with that challenge, particularly if we see more consolidation on a go-forward basis? Let's say in the UK, we've just been through that ourselves. There are other firms getting together. Lots of debate around where thresholds kick in. But any thoughts around, okay, you're now having to that sort of level playing field requirement?
Well, this is a very challenging question, because it's a very challenging problem, as you say. My first bit of advice would be, don't underestimate the amount of work that will be involved in terms of preparing the necessary data infrastructure in order to get membership to this very special and exclusive club, to use your words earlier. The production of data, the granularity required, the degree of depth of content that accompanies all that in the base of preparation submissions stretches to...
The structured and the unstructured data requests was really a detailed description of how you do things, right?
Very, very detailed. You know, there's I'm going to say, a dozen plus templates that have to go in as part of a stress testing exercise, as well as, you know, a handful that go in on a quarterly basis on credit risk. Yeah. And then the basis of preparation document can easily span into the thousand of pages plus, depending on size and complexity, of course. But, you know, in the last ACS, there were about 200 questions which banks were required to provide answers to as part of their detailed basis of preparation document. So that's an extensive deliverable in its own right. Going back to my point when I was talking about the main things for execution, planning is very, very important. I would encourage banks to consider dry runs and to consider aligning their ICAP processes and their ACS processes, because fundamentally, to a point I made before, these are all scenario analyses exercises on the same spectrum. And so as much repeatability as you can create and as much familiarity as you can therefore breed about the exercise, the better. I think it's also really important that the tone is set early from senior stakeholders around the importance of the exercise. This is not something that will be done at the side of the desk and succeed. This will be something that needs to be resourced fully and properly, and people will need to think hard about it, because it's an intellectual exercise as much as anything else. And so again, the key thing is not to underestimate the effort. I think that the Bank of England would recognize that for new entrants into the ACS and would give them sufficient time to prepare and sufficient leeway during their early interactions and submissions, but don't underestimate it. It is a big undertaking. It needs to be resourced well, and attention needs to be paid, and close monitoring is required.
So, to summarize once more, the way I think about it is it's now a pretty mature process here in the UK, but also in Europe, where, as you reminded me before we started chatting, you know, the US and the Europeans have been doing stress testing a lot longer than the UK has, and the UK's learned an awful lot of lessons from that approach. It's going to continue to evolve, and as a sort of career opportunity, it's incredibly useful for Treasury people, but other areas, to spend some time in this, because clearly there are lessons to be learned here. And if you really want to understand how a balance sheet operates, particularly under stress, this is a good area to focus on.
You took the words out of my mouth on that one. And this isn't just to make me feel good about my role, but I think stress testing is an incredible discipline to be involved in, because it sits, I mean, different banks are structured differently, but it always sits at that apex of treasury, risk and finance. And it gives the people who are involved in running it and coordinating it access and exposure to all the different elements that we have to consider when we think about end-to-end balance sheet analysis and testing. And so it's a great seat from which to learn. It's a great seat from which to see the bigger picture. And of course, you know, it's a critical regulatory deliverable that has very strong command and interest from senior governance as well. So it's a really great place to cut one's trade. I feel that it's a real opportunity to get insights into what everyone around the organization is doing. And that can only open doors and broaden horizons.
Ronnie Driver, thank you very much for taking part in this podcast. And we look forward to seeing you at future ALMA events.
Thanks very much, Justin. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon, and in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?